I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 141 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week was a Beatle until August 16th, 1962, drummer Pete Best. On behalf of the other Beatles, manager Brian Epstein dismissed Best from the band a couple weeks before their early September recording session at EMI Studios with producer George Martin. Best's replacement was Ringo Starr, formerly of the Liverpool band Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, and the Beatles, as we would come to know them, were on their way to conquering the world. There's already been so much talk and speculation about Best's firing that we won't focus on it here. What's important to note is that Best and his mother, Mona, were key figures in the Beatles' history and evolution. Mona opened the Cosbah Coffee Club in the basement of the family's Victorian mansion in Liverpool in 1959, and the Quarrymen, an early Beatles incarnation featuring John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and one Ken Brown, became the resident band there. And when the Beatles needed a drummer for their 1960 residency at a club in Hamburg, Germany, they called on Best. He'd been drumming with another group, the Blackjacks. Best takes us through those early years, including the truly bonkers way that Mona was able to buy that huge house, her opening of the Cosbah, Pete's discovered passion for drumming, and how he became a Beatle. He also shares vivid memories of the band's two grueling stints in Hamburg, their living condition and playing conditions amid the city's red light district. What really happened when Paul and Pete were arrested and jailed for attempted arson there? How are the Beatles a different band when they returned to Liverpool? What was the band's dynamic like? Was John clearly the leader? What was Paul like? What was George like? Which were the first Lennon-McCartney songs that Best played on? What did he think of them? What were the Beatles' recording sessions for Decca Records like?
I saw a girl in my dreams, and so it seems that I will love.
How has Best's perspective on his experience with the Beatles changed over the years? When was the last time he spoke with any of the other Beatles? Best is still out there performing with some U.S. dates coming up, and the Best family also is turning their old mansion into a Beatles-themed inn. I never thought I'd have a chance to talk with Pete Best, and I'm pretty sure you'll share my enthusiasm for all he has to say. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Pete Best.
Each time I look into your eyes, I see that there heaven lies. And as I look, I see the love of love.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for coming on.
You as well.
You're still in Liverpool, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, wouldn't move if nothing on God's earth will make me move Liverpool, you know.
Nice. You're coming to the States at some point to tour again, right?
Yeah, it's a very short tour at the end of July. We're doing four dates, 25th through to the 29th. 25th, we're a weekend of Bertha's in Delaware. Club 66 in Maryland on the 26th. Dale Ballroom, I believe it's Columbus, Ohio, on the 27th. Kent Stage, nearly forgot. Last but not least, Kent Stage. That's Ohio. That'll be our final date. So it's a very quick tour, but we're looking forward to it because we haven't been to the States for quite some time.
Yeah, so why such a short tour?
Because of what's going on at the present moment. We've got availabilities, we could fit it in. We've had numerous requests. To be quite honest, Mark, we could have extended the tour most probably to about another 2 weeks. The request we've had to actually stay out there, but we can't because we've got a club to run. We've got a hotel which is due to open on an Airbnb which is due to open on August 1, we're very excited about, which is above the world famous Cosbah Coffee Club. We've converted my mother's house.
I was going to say that's your house. If it's right above the coffee club.
It is, yeah. It's our childhood homes, basically. But what we've done to continue Mona's story and her legacy, we've converted the Victorian mansion above the Cosbah into what we call the Cosbah Coffee Club Suites. And we put it through Airbnb. The opening date's August 1, but we've converted the house into five suites. Hence the McCartney Suite, hence the Lennon Suite, Sutcliffe Suite, Harrison Suite, and the Best Suite. And the reason for that is that, for those of you who don't know, the Beatles played here, they slept here.
Of course.
They frolicked here.
They formed there, basically, right? I mean, didn't the Quarrymen basically form in the Casbah?
Reformed, if that's the best word for it. Yeah, it wasn't the originals. It was part of it with another guy called Ken Brown. But because of that reformation of the Quarrymen, it led to the Beatles, the Silver Beatles, hence, and onwards. And that's where I joined the story, so to speak. But going back to the hotel, the reason for it being that we wanted to continue Mona's legacy. So it's bookable now. So anyone who wants to stay and be part of Beatle folklore,
wow,
get onto Airbnb, Casbah Coffee Club Suites. And if you don't want to be part of Beatle folklore, if you're not a Beatle fanatic, then just come, feel part of the history that goes on within the house. You'll enjoy it whichever way. So put it down on your bucket list.
Look, I am long overdue to visit Liverpool, which I've never done. So if I do it, that's the place to go.
Most definitely, most definitely.
Now, is the Best Suite your childhood room, or was it your mom Mona's where she stayed, or was it a different one?
No, because we all slept in different rooms all over the house. The rooms have no semblance to what actually went on. We've just named them because of what we felt was appropriate. So the Lennon Suite has no bearing on the fact that John Lennon slept there. He would have done, most probably, like they've slept in all the bedrooms all over the house at various times and stages. So the soliloquy of it, the sequence of it, we've just named them because, you know, they need to be named. The Best Suite happens to be the top floor, because that's where before, if I can put this into chronological order, before we opened the Casbah Club, that's where my gang of merry men used to play in the cellars, okay? But when the cellars were being converted into the Casbah Coffee Club, we migrated upstairs into the attics upstairs. So that's why the whole top floor, which is four bedrooms, it's a big suite, that's become the Best Suite, simply because of the fact that's where
nice
my gang and the Beatles hung out when we were having fun.
And where are you living in proximity to all of this?
Yeah, I'm still in West Derby Village. For those of you who don't know, Casbah Club is smack dab in the middle of West Derby Village, about 3 or more miles from town centre. So it's very easily accessible on the bus, taxi. Everyone knows it. So I'm still in the neighbourhood. You know, I'm still a West Derby boy, if you could put it that way. I love it. Spent most of my life here, and most probably see out my roots here as well, hopefully.
Nice. Well, if there were a Pete Best room that was recreating what your room was like, you know, when you lived there, you know, in your like late teens, what would have been on the walls for that?
What would have been on the walls for that? At that stage, most probably a picture of Presley. I wasn't into drums at that early stage yet, though, even though I have a quick transformation. So there would have been a guitar knocking around the room somewhere. Like every other kid in Liverpool, you went out and bought a guitar when Skiffle happened and
right,
blasted away on your three chords. And then found out very much too. my relief that, you know, I wasn't destined to be a guitar player, you know, I was more suited to playing drums. So within that particular confine of my bedroom, there would have been a drum kit as well, or parts of a drum kit. A little desk where I used to study, because I was still at school. I was taking A-levels, and that was basically my domain, you know. I used to play up there, sleep up there, study up there, have fun up there, basically.
What were the first drums that you got?
First drums I got were Premier. And reason for that was, Mark, when it was decided I was going to play drums, which was happened after the Quarrymen stopped playing at the Casbah, and Ken Brown, who was a member of the Quarrymen, came up and said, Pete, you know, we need a band because I've let Mona down. You know, the Quarrymen aren't going to play here. They did eventually, but under a different guise. And we turned around and said, okay, let's put a band together. So I happened to know a couple of guys called Chaz Newby and Bill Barlow, a great guitarist. And I went and saw them and turned around and said, yeah, thinking of forming a band. And he said, fine. Went back and saw Ken and said, everything's fine, Ken, we just need a drummer. So we turned around and said, well, that's no problem. He said, you're going to be the drummer. So I turned around and said, well, there is a problem, Ken, because I haven't got any drums. So, Mark, what you do or what you did in those days, I went and saw my mum and dad. And we basically decided that I wasn't going to get a full drum kit. They wanted to see how I persevered with a snare drum and a cymbal. So for weeks and weeks on end, I smashed away on a snare drum and a cymbal till I became quite proficient. And then the big day came, went and saw them and turned around and said, yep, I'm ready for the drum kit. And I went down to Rushworth and Draper's, which was the, at that time, the biggest musical store in Liverpool. And I saw a wonderful old man called Mr. Swift, who was the drum mentor for Rushworth. And I went in, and as I walked into Rushworth, I always remembered it to this day. There was a kit which took my eye. It was a sky blue Premier, okay, sky blue pearl Premier drum kit. And I fell in love with it when I walked in. And I went and saw Mr. Swift and explained what had happened. And he had sent around and said, what's the best drum kit you think I can start on, Mr. Swift? And he went, that one over there, Pete. And he pointed to the sky blue pearl Premier drum kit.
Right.
And that was it. That was my first drum kit, and I fell in love with it. Yeah. And I played it for many, many years till I changed over to Ludwig.
How did you learn how to play drums back there? It wasn't like you're sort of going online and seeing demonstrations on YouTube or anything. Were you playing along to records and kind of figuring it out? Like, how did that work?
Yeah, well, I've become infatuated with a great drummer. You know, it was a big band drummer, jazz drummer called Gene Krupa. And I'd seen him in old films and watched the way he played and loved his rhythm style, his, you know, a lot of tom-tom work and everything like that. And that was basically who I tried to emulate at that early stage, as well as listening to early rock and roll, you know. So it was a combination of both, listening to records, playing along to records, being fortunate to have live music played in the cellars of your club, because there were other bands playing downstairs, you know, which I could go and watch their drummers. And it was a great time for a learning period. And you develop your own style, and that's basically what happened with a lot of drummers in Liverpool. I think there were, my goodness me, in those days, if you went up to a drummer and turned around and said, did you have drumming lessons? The answer would most probably be no. Or the percentage would be so low, it'd be virtually nil. Most of us were self-taught. You know, we listened to stuff and we emanated stuff and we copied and we practiced and developed your own style from there.
And the Kasbah Club was, again, in the basement of your house. Hmm. I'd read that it was actually your idea to open it. Is that right?
Not quite. It was my mother's idea, but I landed with the job of. What happened was we'd been watching a program called about the Two Ice Coffee Club in London, which, of course, spawned the likes of Cliff Richard and Tony Sheridan and Wee Willie Harris, all the famous rockers that emanated from Liverpool, from England. And we were watching that. And the end of it, Mona turned around, my mother, and she basically turned around and said, Pete, we've got cellars downstairs, haven't we? So I said, yep. So she said, what do you think about we turn them into a coffee club where we can put live music on, you know, rock and roll bands? And I said, oh, it's an absolutely wonderful idea there. And she said, fine, I'm glad you agree. So I turned around and said, who's going to do that? She said, you are. Mm. Okay, so that was my job for the next 6 months with my gang of friends. We converted the cellars into what became the Kasbah Coffee Club.
What's interesting about it is that you sort of look at all of the sort of the dominoes that had to fall for, you know, these massive changes in music and, you know, the Beatles and the Mercy Beat and everything else. Mm-hmm. You guys opening that club was a pretty big start to that, right?
Yeah, well, we've always turned around and said the Kasbah Coffee Club was the birthplace of the Beatles, and for many, many of the bands which emanated out of Liverpool, you know, they all played here. Jerry and the Pacemakers, Mersey Beats. Oh, you could go on. Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas, Ted Taylor and the Dominoes, the Searchers, etc., etc., etc. But the other thing, flip side of the coin, Mark, is that Mona was very, how could I turn around and say, opportunistic for young kids. So she just didn't give the established bands, if I could put it that way, but the followings, all the bookings. She gave a lot of the spawning bands, you know, the bands that were just starting out in Liverpool. She gave them the opportunity to play there. And she basically turned around and said, all it is, if you go down well and the crowd likes you, you'll get another booking. If they don't, then go away, practice. The door's not closed and we bring you back again. And that's what happened. You know, there were bands which, you know, failed at the first hurdle, but they came back again and established themselves and went on to bigger things, which was wonderful. So, you know, the Casbah, as well as it being a haven for teenagers, and also as the Beatles turned around and said, you know, their social club, our social club, and a social club for a lot of the musicians in Liverpool, it also became home for a lot of the younger musicians as well. So it was a great learning place, you know, to mix, swap ideas, you know, be what you wanted to be, basically. So that was the whole concept of Mona's outlook. You know, she wanted people to enjoy themselves and be what they wanted to be.
How much did it cost to get in?
Wow, in those days, on a band night, it cost 1 shilling.
Wow.
Okay. So I'm trying to equate that into, okay, English money, that would be 5p. American money, I don't know, was probably a nickel or a dime or something like that.
Yeah.
It just doesn't bear any resemblance to, you know, the prices that get taken now. But the funny thing was, those prices went up slightly because when the Beatles played there and they established themselves, they went up to what we used to call in those days half a crown. Okay. Mm. Which was a coin and all expression, 2 and 6. Okay. So the prices did go up when the Beatles
played. There you go. As well, they should have. How many people fit in there?
Well, believe it or not, 300 to 400 comfortably. Okay. And that's a mixture of standing, sitting, crouching, whatever else they got up to. But we used to have audiences which were basically, I think the biggest audience that we played to down here was 1,000 people.
Wow.
But that didn't mean to turn around and say there was 1,000 people inside the club. Because what used to happen, and that was the wonderful thing about the Casbah. For those of you who don't know, the Casbah stands in about half an acre of its own grounds. It's a, you know, wonderful old Victorian mansion, detached Victorian mansion. So on summer nights, you know, the kids would fall out the club, not drunk, but I mean fall out simply to go and sit in the garden. They could still hear the music, even though they couldn't see the, you know, the musicians, and still enjoy the music. So that was how, you know, the membership grew and grew and grew. So those who wanted to sweat and, you know, be part of the crowd on the inside of the Casbah, they did that. Those that didn't, they wanted to stay outside. They enjoyed themselves outside, but still had the chance to listen to the music. That was the wonderful thing about it.
The story I'd read also was that your mom, Mona, had pawned all this jewelry and betted on this 33-to-1 horse.
Oh,
and that was where you got the money to buy the house. Is that true?
Yes, yes, yes. My goodness me. Yes, that was the caliber of the woman. I could go on and talk about Mona all day, you know, never mind anything else. But to get the house, basically what happened, my younger brother on his way home from school saw this wonderful Victorian mansion, which was run down, very dilapidated, in Hayman's Green. Had been an old conservative club. And he came back and told my mother, Mo, and turned around and said, there's a house you might be interested in Hayman's Green, Mo, because Mo always wanted to, coming from a military family out in India, which had been stationed out there since the time of the Raj, she was used to big properties, you know, so she had a sight set on owning a bigger property. And she went and looked at it, fell in love with it, even though it was like Dracula's castle initially. And came back and saw my dad, John, and basically went, you know, what do you think, John? And John turned around and said, no, I'm not interested, Mona. Big white elephant. No, we're not going to move. Quite happy here. So that's how she turned around and so rightly said she didn't tell anyone. Showed the determination. She wasn't going to be put off. She didn't tell anyone. She went and pawned all the jewelry. And she bet it on a horse called Never Say Die, which ran in the 1954 Derby, I think. And it was, the jockey was a young apprentice jockey in those days called Lester Piggott, which went on to worldwide acclaim. And we were watching the 54 Derby and we saw Never Say Die winning, coming up closer, closer and closer. And when it crossed the line, Mona jumped up in the air and basically, like a screaming banshee, basically turned around and said, I've won the house, I've won the house. What the hell? We were looking at turning around and said, what the hell are you talking about? You won the house, you won the house. Then she turned around and told us what she'd done.
Oh, my God.
Which we looked and went, Mo, it's wonderful that you've done that. The other side of the coin was, what would happen if Never Say Die had lost? She said, I didn't even think about that. I didn't even think about that. But what a godsend that was. Never Say Die won. With that, Mo bought the house. She became the first woman in England to get a mortgage. So that was another feather in her cap.
Really?
And
the first woman in England to get a mortgage, period.
Get a mortgage, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Well, now we're talking about 54 now, so it's going back a long time. And Never Say Die ever since then has become the family slogan. You know, that's our war cry.
Yeah, 33 to one shot, and assuming you're going to win, that takes some guts there.
Yeah, it was a rank outsider. We turned around and said, after the aftermath of the success and, you know, the furor of winning and the excitement and their jubilation, we turned around and said, what made you pick, you know, 33 to one outsider with an apprentice jockey on it? She said, just like the name. Just like the name, Never Say Die.
All right.
So she's Never Say Die is now our family war cry. Yeah, it's lived with us and we live by it. Okay.
There's your movie right there. You need the Mona movie. That's an amazing story. But from that,
we've always said it. Hoping someone out there one day will make it. Right.
And then you joined the Beatles because they needed a drummer for Hamburg.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you knew them already. Were they already playing in the Casbah at that point?
Not as the Beatles. They played there as the Quarrymen without a drummer. That was in the Ken Brown scenarios. And then when I put the little band together with Ken Brown and Chaz and Billy, we called ourselves the Blackjacks. And we played the Casbah, and we got quite a following in Liverpool as a result of that. Consequently, when the Beatles were looking for a drummer, they'd heard a little bit about the fact of what was going on at the Cas. They'd come down and seen me playing. And then around about August 1960, I got this fateful phone call from Paul McCartney, which explained the position about us. They had the offer to go to Germany, but they needed a drummer. And they put the deal to me, and I turned around and said, fine, I'll go and ask my boys, you know, see how they feel about it, which I did. And they turned around and said, Pete, we don't want to go professional, so, you know, go with our love and blessings. So the next thing is, went and saw my mum and dad, and they turned around and said, if it's what you want to do, son, you know, go with our blessings. So I went back to Paul and basically turned around and said, yep. So he said, okay, Pete. He said, throw your drums in a taxi, come down the following day to the Wyvern Club, which later became the famous Blue Angel Club in Liverpool. And we blasted off about six numbers, just standard numbers, which everyone used to play in those days. No one was into writing their own material, not at that stage anyway. So they went away for about 5 minutes, you know, stood in the corner, mutter, came back, basically turned around and said, yep, you're in, Pete. When Alan Williams came in, they turned around and said to Alan, this is Pete, the new drummer. And Alan Williams, who was taken out to Germany, turned around and said, well, yeah, he said, that was a foregone conclusion, Pete. He said, we'd seen you play. I'd seen you play. And, you know, we were quite happy with what we saw. So I said, well, what was the idea making me audition then, Alan? So he turned around and said, oh, well, that was a very simple piece. He said, we made you audition just in case you asked for more money. So that was it. Typical Scouse rules. Okay, you audition if you ask for more money. But if it hadn't been for that audition and that phone call, I may never have joined the Beatles. And a couple of days after that, I was on a wonderful adventure, which took me to Hamburg.
So at that point, it was John, Paul, George, Stuart Sutcliffe.
That's right.
And you.
Yes, he was playing bass, yeah.
And so how well did you know each of them before you went to Hamburg?
Well, through them playing at the Casbah as the Quarrymen. And they'd helped decorate the Casbah, you know, before the job was given to them. Hence, you know, the Casbah still stands today and the people visit the Casbah now because it is a tourist attraction. They'll see the Aztec ceiling that John painted, the rainbow ceiling that McCartney painted, the salmon ceiling that Harrison painted, the London caricature over the fireplace that Cynthia painted, the stars on the ceiling that we all painted, the spider's web that I painted, blah, 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 and it goes on and on and on. But it's still the only original place in Liverpool where you can actually see that their artwork is still there, which is absolutely fantastic. So I'd known them from before the club opened as workmates and sort of helping decorate the club. I'd got to know them for 12 months through playing at the Casbah. You know, we'd become quite friendly on that particular basis because they were on a residency and that meant that they were there every Saturday night initially. And then, of course, they used to rehearse there when they had, you know, time available. So by the time I joined them, you know, it wasn't like, you know, total strangers. You know, there was a, you know, we'd known one another previously, even though we weren't school kids, you know, school friends. We knew one another socially through the Casbah.
Were you closer with one of them than the others, or was it all sort of, you know, kind of like friendly at a distance at that point?
I'd say at that point, most probably friendly with all of them, but the longer I stayed with the band, I became closer to John. And that was simply because of the fact that the long hours we spent in Germany, in Hamburg, and John and I used to spend a lot of time drinking afterwards, you know, in the clubs. And at that stage, I realized that, you know, there was another side to John, which was a lot of people didn't see. For, you know, I think what a lot of people saw initially was this very bombastic, sardonic-witted person, you know, which to me was a defense mechanism with John. You know, that was his way of keeping people at bay. What I did see, the more and more I spent more time with him, and I think people saw that many, many years afterwards, but I was fortunate to see it in an early stage, that there was a very tender and a very emotional side to John. And being privileged to see that at a very early age, taking those two entities and putting them together made John the total man for me. And, you know, my friendship grew with him. So friends with all of them. But I think out of everyone, I admired John the most.
Mm. When they asked you to go to Hamburg, you probably had this vision of or imagination of what you thought that experience was going to be like. Mm. Then you actually got there. How did it differ from what you expected?
Well, as we put in an old expression, it was rock and roll. Yeah, the teenager's dream. We had visions of going out to Hamburg, and, you know, playing in this fantastic club, you know, and, you know, wowing the crowds, you know, sweeping them off the feet. What we didn't realize is that we were going to Hamburg, the St. Pauli area, which at that moment was the biggest red light quarter in the world, I think. You know, if it wasn't the biggest, then it was one of the biggest. And we found that out very, very soon. That, you know, this is one of the toughest neighborhoods in Hamburg. And, you know, with the, you know, sex on every doorway. So it was, as well as our musical education improved and our sexual education improved very quickly as well. So it was a hell of a learning for us. But yeah, totally different because, to be quite honest, when you first approached Hamburg and we came in, Initially, we went over by, what was it, minibus and then a ferry, and then we drove through from Harwich through to Arnhem and then through to Hamburg. When we were approaching the Reeperbahn, which was the area, the St. Pauli area, it changed, and that then became what our vision of Hamburg would be. You know, it was the neon lights, the clubs, the doorman, the atmosphere, you know, the excitement, you know, the crowds. That was something which was totally different to Liverpool, you know. And that was the environment that we had to adapt to and grow into very, very quickly.
How are the audiences different from what you'd played to before?
Oh, wow. Well, you've got to remember the audiences there were in licensed clubs. Even though they had Ausweis Patrol, which I think was 10 o'clock, which meant that anyone under the age of 18 had to go home. But up till then, they could drink in the clubs. After 10 o'clock, it was 18 only. But licensed, that was the big difference. So as regards an audience, you had a cosmopolitan audience of, you know, the Hamburg people, the kids of the St. Pauli area, Hamburg being a seaport. You had mariners coming in, you had Royal Navy people coming in, army lads from the, you know, the army stations, which you put, were out there, Bielefeld and Gelsenkirchen, all coming to Hamburg for a good weekend. And it was very cosmopolitan, and it was wild as well, because with it being licensed and with it being a rough house area, we saw lots of fights. You know, it was a commonplace thing, you know, fights in the club, fights in the street. But that was Hamburg. That was the St. Pauli area. You know, people accepted that. We accepted it after a while. It just became part of the entertainment scene that was going on in Hamburg at that time.
Did you fear for your own safety at times?
No, because we were always together. We didn't split up. I think initially, if you saw the Beatles in Hamburg, you never saw anyone singly. You know, there was always four or five of us, you know. So, you know, it was one of those where safety in numbers are supposed to expect. You know, even though we were Liverpool lads and we could look after ourselves, till we adjusted. And, you know, we got a lot of help from the waiters as well, you know, who were the, you know, the strong arm guys. And through those waiters, you know, they became our bodyguards. They became our protection units, you know, so they made sure that nothing happened to us, you know, either inside the club or outside the club. So it was good having them on our side as well.
Nice. Were the audiences kind of this flow of new people, or were there, did after a while, were there like, oh yeah, that those people up front, they were here last week, and, you know, you start to recognize people because they're coming back for you?
Oh yeah, as well as the transient crowd. There were regulars used to come in. And I think I'd turn around and say at least 50% of the audience that we attracted were regulars. You know, the rest of it was transient. You know, it could be tourists, seamen, you know, soldiers. But that was the business. That was the trade that was going on in, the, you know, the Grosser Freiheit area, the Reeperbahn area. It was a tourist attraction. So there was an element of the regulars and whatever else attracted to the clubs.
What were like the big show-stopping songs you guys did, like sort of the climax of the set?
Oh, wow. Going back in those days, most probably What Did I Say?
The Ray Charles song.
Ray Charles song, yeah. It was a, you know, great one for the crowd. And, you know, that was one thing about the German audiences and the kids in Liverpool when we brought it back to Liverpool. You know, there wasn't just the German audiences, but you gave the audiences the chance to join in. And of course, Ray Charles' number, What Did I Say, gives you that element, you know, in the, you know, the hey, 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 hey. And, you know, the German audiences took to it. Plus the fact, the antics we used to get up to on stage during that, you know, it wasn't just the number. It was all this whole cacophony of sound and showmanship that was going on stage. John jumping off the piano, doing his Nureyev splits. you know, other people down on bended knees, you know, it was just a fun time. And it was wonderful because the German audiences and the kids in Liverpool at a later stage bought into it. So whenever, you know, towards the end of the night or the end of the set, you could guarantee that there'd be a cry from the crowd, which is basically What Did I Say. And that was our piece of basically go nuts basically on stage.
Huh. Well, and that second part of what I say, you could just sort of stretch that out as long as you want.
We did. Yeah, we played that one and we stretched that out as long as we felt. If it was going well for us, then we kept it going. If it was a quieter night, then we'd give it about two or three turns and then close it down.
Were you doing any Lennon-McCartney originals on that first trip to Hamburg?
No, not on the first one, Mark. That emanated a little bit more on the second one when we went back to the Top Ten Club. Simply because we'd started to introduce original material in Liverpool, because a lot of the bands, when we came back and the type of material we were playing, started to copy a lot of the material that we were playing. And there used to be a fight to get to the record stores to get the new releases, try and be the first to actually play them on stage. So we put up with this for a while. And because we were top band in Liverpool, we had to basically show the other bands that there was something more, a little bit more about us than, you know, just being a pure copy band. Even though we enjoyed playing the American greats, you know, that's what we cut our teeth on. So because of the fact that John and Paul, Lennon, McCartney had written, you know, original material at a very early age, we started to introduce some of that into the act. You know, the likes of like Dreamers Do, Love the Loved. And also, you know, there was an element of taking all numbers, and this was more Paul at that stage, and, you know, putting a twist on them, like Besame Mucho was a big one.
Right.
Feet's Too Big, that was another big one. So as well as the original material, we were dipping into the real old stuff and put a revamp in that back. But what we found, even though that was catching on, the kids were more interested in the fact that we were turning around and saying, and here's a song that we've written, right? And the fact it was like, wow, the Beatles write their own material. And that was the, I suppose you could turn around and say, it wasn't just the fans who basically got onto that. The other bands got onto that as well. These guys are playing their own original material and it's going down well on stage. So, besame mucho. I'll love you forever, say that you'll always be mine.
Caropop is supported by Revolution Brewing, the new sponsor of the Pitchfork Music Festival in Chicago. Congratulations, Revolution. Revolution is Illinois' largest independent brewery and the maker of, among other great beers, the classic Antihero IPA and the premium lager Cold Time. On these scorching summer days, Cold Time really hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. Do you remember the first song that one of them brought in for you guys to play?
Original song?
Yeah.
Off the top of my head, it was either Love of the Loved or Like Dreamers Do. I wouldn't hedge best and turn around and say which one it was, because they both came in around about the same time.
Yeah, I think both of those are Paul songs. That, I mean, they were kind of working together, but and then there was Hello Little Girl, I remember, was that those are the three that are on the deck of things too.
I think Love of the Loved and Like Dreamers Do just had the edge on Hello Little Girl.
What'd you think of them?
I thought they were great. I mean, we played them at the Decca audition. It was any good. But it just showed the caliber of the songs. You know, when Mike Smith came down, he listened to us, he liked them, and it was like, yeah, you know, play them in the set. We liked the feel of them as well. We used to put a bit of time into the arrangements of it. It wasn't just a case of, okay, we'll throw it together and do it. You know, we rehearsed it, so that by the time we actually did it on stage, it was quite a respectable number. You know, it was one that we could basically turn around and play with a lot of pride, hoping that it would go down well.
Right.
And the rewarding factor was when the kids liked it and, you know, kept asking for it, which they did many, many times afterwards. That was the plus factor. You know, it's like, wow, they're liking the original material. It's another step forward. And if we're going to get a record contract, then it's going to be a plus factor again for us.
When you were working out the arrangements, which for the originals and maybe for the covers too, were you able to sort of figure out your own parts, or was someone like Paul saying, oh, I want you to play it like this?
No. I think harmony-wise, they figured that out for themselves, you know, as regards the lyrics and that, because they were, you know, great vocalists amongst themselves, both individually and as a trio. But I think drumming parts and, you know, bass lines and all the rest of it, people relied on their own musicianship. And if it worked for everyone within the band, if everyone was happy for it, then we kept it. If we didn't like it, we'd try something else, you know. But there, no one basically turned around and said, play this or play that, or play this tempo or play that tempo. You know, right. Everyone contributed. And I think that was one of the good things about it. Everyone had a little say in the matter.
You had two stints in Hamburg. Going back to the first one, you know, you're coming out of this big Victorian house. The living arrangements there were a little bit different. Did they take some getting used to?
Quite a bit of getting used to. Mm-hmm. The first trip over, we stayed in the back of second-rate flea pit, the Bambi Kino, which showed old porn films. And we thought we were going to be playing the Kaiser Keller. That was another culture shock. We were told, no, you're not going to be playing the Kaiser Keller. Because when we got to Hamburg and we went into meet Bruno Koschmider, that was the first club we went into. And the Kaiser Keller was jumping. You know, Derry and the seniors were there. And it was like, wow, the atmosphere was there. The audience was going wild. And it was like, wow, we can't wait to get up and play on here. And then we got told by Bruno Koschmider, who basically taught us, taking us out there, no, you're not playing here, you're playing at the Indra, which is further down the street. And as you walk down the Grosse Freiheit, the top of it is all full of neon lights, and then it gets to the bottom and it gets darker and darker and darker. And we came to this grotty little club right at the bottom of the Grosse Freiheit. And we went in there, and there were two people in there arguing over the price of a beer. And Bruno Koschmider turned around to us and went, you are going to have to turn this into another Kaiser Keller. So we looked at ourselves and we turned around and said, yep, it's rock and roll. That's what we're here for. We'll take it on the chin. And we said, fine. Okay, when do we start? He said, you start tomorrow night. And we said, how long do we play? And he said, well, Monday to Friday, he said, you play from 7 o'clock till 2 o'clock in the morning with 15-minute breaks. And then Saturday and Sunday, you will start at 6 o'clock and finish at 4 o'clock with 15-minute breaks. So that was the, I suppose you could turn around and say that was the challenge we had, the hours, you know, but we coped with that. And then we turned around and said, fine, we're from Liverpool, it's rock and roll, we'll get on with it. Doesn't worry us, we'll make sure it works. So we said, where are we staying? Hence, we got taken over the road to this flea-bit cinema and went in through the back door. And there was a light at the end of the corridor. And if I remember right, John, George, and Stu ran for that light. And when they got there, that was one of the bedrooms. And in the bedroom, if you can call it that, there was a camp bed, a couch, and a bed, right? So that was three people that could sleep in there, and there's five of us, right? So Paul and I turned around to Bruno and went, hey, Bruno, there's only three beds here. Where do we sleep? He said, oh, you passed it on the way down, right? So Paul and I backtracked, no lights, nothing. And we came across these two, as we turned around and said, concrete dungeons with a hole knocked out in the middle of the wall so Paul and I converse with one another. And that became our home for the next 4 or 5 months. You know, no lights. If we wanted to write home, we either went in the posh room, which was further up the corridor, or grabbed a torch and strapped it on our heads like the old miners used to do.
Wow.
A lot of fun.
You guys have mattresses at least?
Well, we thought we did. You know, we believed there were mattresses, yeah.
Well, again, there's one of the stories I read was that when you guys were going back, or not, you weren't planning to go back at that some point, but when you'd left staying in the cinema, you and Paul had gone back, and I think Paul set a condom on fire, and that it caused a fire there, and you guys spent time in jail and got sent home. Is that
true? Basically, what happened was because we'd gone to, how the story of Omar was that we'd gone to the Top Ten Club, which was a very posh club on the Reeperbahn. Because Tony Sheridan, who was one of our heroes from the old boy days, was playing there, and we realised that we could go and watch him. And we used to do that in our break, and we were there one night watching, dressed in our leathers and cowie boots, loading it up like we're the Beatles, Kings of Hamburg. And Peter Ekman, who was the manager of the club, came over, and he turned around and said, "Are you the Beatles?" And we said, yeah, we are. And he turned around and said, "Got a business proposition to put to you." So we said, "Yeah, okay, we're listening, you know." Being very blasé about the fact, you know, being Scousers and Kings of Hamburg now. You know, we conquered the clubs. And he turned around and said, like you to play at the Top Ten Club, like you to play with Tony Sheridan. So we said, sounds interesting, we'll think about it. So he turned around and he said, I'll pay you more money than what you're getting at the Kaiser Keller. So with that, we turned around and said, okay, when do we start? So he said, how about tomorrow night? So we said, yeah, okay, we'll go back and tell Bruno Koschmida. So we went back and told Bruno Koschmida. Bruno Koschmida, to cut a long story short, turned around and said, if you go and play the Top Ten Club, you will never play Germany again. To which the Beatles gave him the royal salute with two fingers and disappeared out, and the next day played the Top Ten Club. All of a sudden, George Harrison gets sent home for being underage, being there 4 months, 4.5 months. Paul and I had to go and get some what's left of our belongings from the old Bambi Kino. So with there being no lights in there, we had some condoms. Maca stuck the condom on the wall, gave us enough light to throw our clothes together, went back to the Top Ten Club, thought no more about it, played, went to bed. The next morning, we got woken up by two so-called policemen, right? Yanked off to the Davidstrasse, which was the local jail on the Reeperbahn. The police station. And we got charged with attempting to burn the Bambi Kino down, right? And we were taken from there to Hamburg jail. Paul and I thought, my God, this is the end of Paul and Pete. Never to be seen again, locked up in Hamburg jail. You know, convicts at the age of 18. We were deported back home, right? But we fought the case. Mona and Alan Williams helped us, and we finally got ourselves cleared with the German consul in Liverpool, who basically turned down and said, okay, I understand what happened. I can see, you know, the histrionics behind it. It wasn't your fault, et cetera, et cetera. We'll allow you back into Germany. Okay, so that was great because we could go back and play the Top Ten Club. But he turned around and said, there is one underlying condition, Mr. Best and Mr. McCartney. He said, when you go back to Germany, he said, if you do anything wrong, he said, you will be flung out again. He said, do I make myself clear? So Paul and I said, of course you would. Of course you will. You know, we were the Beatles. We went back to Germany, and we were up to the same bloody tricks that we did before. So,
was there actually damage done to the club from the fire, or did they just?
No. I mean, don't get me wrong. The allegations of trying to burn the Bambi Kino down. I think there were a couple of little scorch marks on a concrete wall. You know, so as we've always turned around and said, how the hell can you burn a bloody concrete cinema down with a couple of condoms? You know, it just doesn't work, you know.
But it wasn't like when you guys left, the fire department was coming in with their hoses and stuff.
Oh, my God, no. I think there's one film, Birth of the Beatles, which was a Dick Clark movie, which totally went over the top on that. You know, as regards, you know, fire engines coming and hoses and fire running in and all the rest of it. No, it was just like, you know, you wouldn't even thought. I think there would have been more light off if we'd have done it with a match, you know, as opposed to a condom on the wall. You know, that was how big the damage was. It was, you know, minimal, like, you know. And the place was a dirty bag anyway.
So staying in those close quarters, like how did your relationships within the band change and evolve over that time?
Made us more determined because of the straight hours we were playing and what we had to confront as regards to the audiences. We had to win the audiences over as well. And we were basically a new band to to Hamburg. We didn't go in with a reputation or anything like that. So it was very much a case of self-proving, which we did in a very, very quick period of time. But I've always turned around and said the long hours which we played were like constant rehearsal for us, Mark. And consequently, because of that, the camaraderie grew within the band because of the long hours we were playing, the fact that we were in these poor living quarters, the fact that we were in, you know, the St. Pauli area, the tough quarter of Hamburg, you know, it made us resilient, but it also made us grow stronger to one another, you know, as a unit. You know, we relied on one another. And that became more apparent on stage and off stage as well. So I think it was a learning curve. All of that put into the embryo stage, you know, we grew with it, you know, as our confidence grew, as our maturity grew, as we became more dominant in Hamburg as regards to playing force, so our confidence grew and so our, you know, the way we looked upon life in Hamburg changed as well.
You had these incredibly long hours too. Is that sort of when at least some band members were sort of taking like amphetamines, something to just keep them up because you're working these crazy long shifts?
No, not on the first set. Not on the first trip out there. That was more so in the second set. And it's simply because the fact that, I forget now whether it was the waiters or whether it was Mutti, the toilet attendants who put them onto Prellies, which were just slimming tablets, but they gave you a little bit of a high. And that was the start of it, basically, you know. I didn't use it. I was quite prepared to fire off, you know, my whiskey and schnapps that kept me going for the night. But the others dabbled a little bit, nothing heavy, you know. Used to basically muster them through the night, you know. Didn't affect anyone, didn't make them addictive to them or anything like that. It was just right. We were feeling a little bit tired or under par. They'd pop a Prellie and get on with the show, simple as.
And you were just like, I don't want to be part of that.
I suppose with being coming from a sporting background, because I was very sporting as an active, you know, as a kid, playing rugby and swimming and everything, it was something which didn't appeal to me, you know. I'll drink with the rest of them. I'll drink like a fish if you want me to, you know. That's why give me a, you know, maybe schnapps and a bottle of beer and I'll fire all night. That keeps me going, you know.
I think it was Mark Lewison's book, Tune In, which is this, you know, exhaustive, you know, history of the early Beatles. I don't know if you've read that or, you know, read any of those books, but he basically said that by the time the Beatles were done in Hamburg the second time, they played more live shows, or they played basically more live music than any rock band in history up to that point.
Yeah. I can quite well believe it, because if you take the 4.5 months that we played, the hours that we played out there, right? Then we went back to the top 10 club. And even though it was a better club, we were still playing long hours. Okay, the living accommodations were better. Better facilities within the club, better manager. Our living quarters were in the top of the, you know, the top attic, which had been converted for us and for the bands. So everything was, you know, a plus factor for us at that stage. But we were still playing, you know, 7 o'clock to 2 o'clock, Monday to Friday. We were still playing a 12-hour shift on a Saturday. So the hours were still getting churned in. And it was, if you put all those together, compared with what most probably a band in Liverpool played, or any other band universally, would play an hour, most probably 2 hours a night, possibly once or twice a week. You know, the amount of hours that we played and shows that we did was gastronomical.
Yeah. Right. Well, and it's funny because you think about like right now, there are so many bands, you know, there's just millions of bands, but back then there weren't millions of bands. And, and they weren't there weren't that as nearly as many clubs, and most clubs didn't have you playing 10 to 12 hour shifts. So the Beatles were the most experienced rock band in the history of rock before you guys had recorded a note.
True, yeah. We've always said, now, and I've said, we became more professional than professionals, you know, and that was without a recording contract. So all of that, you know, that multitude of hours that we put in, when the chance came to actually acquire a recording contract, that was another plus factor for us. You know, we were so confident of our own ability that it was very much a case of, okay, let's just, you know, get on with it and see whether they make the right decision. Which you call Bert Kempfert did.
When you returned from Hamburg to Liverpool and played, you know, for those audiences, could you see in the response of the audiences how much you guys had changed?
We recognized that on the first time that we came back to Liverpool after we'd been kicked out of Hamburg on the first trip. And again, that was through the audience in the Cows Bar. Mo gave us the lifeline because we all drifted back. The club that we should have played at, the top 10 club, which was Alan Williams's club in Liverpool, had burnt down. That was going to be our residency. So we were homeless as we got somewhere to play. So Mona threw us a lifeline. She built us the Fabulous Beatles direct from Hamburg. And I think it was on the 19th of December, 1960, we played in the Casbah as the Beatles. And that particular night, and it was quite funny actually, because Stu Sutcliffe had fallen in love with this beautiful photographer, Astrid, and he'd stayed in Hamburg. And I got my friend Chaz Newby to stand in for a while Stu was away, and play bass, which he did. And even though we asked him to actually take over the, you know, the bass spot, he turned around and said no because he was going on to university, et cetera, et cetera, and he wanted to make a career for himself. But to cut a long story short, Mark, what happened that particular night? John, George and Paul went down, and the kids in the Casbah were very astute. By this time, they had other bands playing there, you know, the likes of Derry and the Seniors, Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, you know, Jerry and the Pacemakers. So they knew what was going on. They weren't idiots. And John, George and Paul went down, and the kids went, hang on a minute, that's John, George and Paul, who used to be in the Quarrymen. So they said, yeah, and then they saw Pete and Chaz, who used to be in the Blackjacks, walking down the stairs. And they went, that's Pete and Chaz, who used to be in the Blackjacks. Who are these Beatles? So they went and saw my mother Mona. And she turned around and said, fear not, fear not. I've had wonderful reports about these guys from Germany, Hamburg. You know, let them play. And they did. And what you've got to remember, Mark, is that in Germany, we've been used to playing to rapturous crowds, screaming, dancing on the tables, banging bottles, yelling for more, you know, drunken audiences and, you know, sober audiences as well, who were just enjoying the music that we were playing. We played the first number. I think Paul kicked off with Red Sails in the Sunset or Good Golly Miss Molly. That was one of his openers. And instead of there being a response at the end of the song like there had been in Germany, which had been like raucous cheers and everything, there was just a silence. Hmm. We were amazed. It was just like, my God, what's happened? You know. And then all of a sudden, the kids just started screaming, right? And it was, I've always turned around and said, that particular night, as regards Liverpool was concerned, the response from the kids in the Casbah, that was the birth of Beatlemania.
Really?
It happened in the Casbah. And the funny thing was, Mark, the next gig we played, and if Mona had been alive, she'd have taken great pleasure in telling you the story. Because the next gig we played was a little in town hall on the boxing night, I think it was. And she opened the club up, the Casbah. She expected to find it full, like it normally was. Wasn't a soul in the place, right? The whole Casbah audience had gone to Little and Town Hall to watch the Fabulous Beatles.
Mm.
And I've turned around and said, that because of the Casbah audience, because of the fact that they migrated to Littleton Town Hall and became part of that audience, that all contributed to what became Beatlemania in Liverpool. But it emanated that Casbah night, that first night just before Christmas at the Casbah.
Did you all have some vision of where you wanted it to go at that point? Like, what was sort of the path of a band on the trajectory that you were on at that point?
We were very determined in getting a record contract. And I think our sights were set on being number one in the English hit parade. That was our goal. You know, coin an old expression that Johnny used to say, it was toppermost of the poppermost, right?
Right.
And that was the driving force behind us. We knew that if we got the chance, then we could possibly do that. Of course, what emanated after that, you know, with the success of Love Me Do and Please Please Me, you know, Beatlemania going global and, you know, them changing the music history of the world, that was something which we never thought of. You know, my God, you know, we never dreamt about that. You know, our sights were set on getting a number one at the top of the English hit parade. And that was our driving force.
Did you all have a song that you thought you were doing that you thought, oh, this is going to be our hit?
Not at that stage, no. Because what had happened in Germany, we recorded Standards. We recorded Mike Bonham and the Saints with Sheridan. We recorded Ain't She Sweet, the old Vincent number, and Cry for a Shadow, which was anything else you wouldn't believe, but an instrumental by the Beatles, you know.
The one Harrison Lennon collaboration.
That's right, yeah. Which came about simply because of the fact of, you know, Rory Storm asked us if we'd heard what Brighton City had been. I think that was the hit that was out at the moment for the Shadows, and we started spoofing about, and you know, Cry for a Shadow came about. And when we were looking for a title, it seemed okay. We were taking a mickey out the Shadows, Cry for a Shadow, hence the title.
Funny.
But yeah, it was funny as well, because when we started playing it, it caught on with the kids. It caught on very quickly with the German audiences, and it also caught on with the audiences in Liverpool. But we didn't think that we were ever going to record an instrumental. You know, that wasn't, you know, if anyone had turned around and said recording, we did in Germany because of the popularity in Bergdamford liked it. But if someone had turned around and said recording, you know, an English recording company, I think the answer would have been no. We had a, you know, we wanted to show our vocal ability and our progress as a band.
Right. Was John the leader of the band? Were John and Paul sort of the co-leaders? What was the dynamic like among the four of you?
I don't know, because I wasn't privy to that. Whether it been a, you know, it's Lennon's band, whether it's John and Paul, you know, when they were the Quarrymen, I don't know. I wasn't privy to that. Basically, what I saw was at the Casbah when they were playing there as the Quarrymen with Ken Brown without a drummer, was they all collaborated. No one was taking the leadership role. I suppose that's the best way to put it. And in Germany, it was very much a case we all collaborated together. You know, no one became a dominant force. But what I did see was after my demise from the band, that I don't know, maybe it was because of the songwriting credits and their name were, you know, in print more than everyone else, you know, Lennon and McCartney originals. It did tend to be very much, even though George was a very powerful force, it did tend to be very much Lennon and McCartney.
Right. Like, who decided what you played when you were doing a show? Did like everyone just sort of say, all right, we're going to do this one. All right, now I want to do this one.
Freedom of choice. That was left up to the individual. Okay. The individual gauged the moments, you know, whether it was going to be a rocker, whether it was going to be a slow one. And we relied basically on individual taste and recognizing what the crowd wanted. You know, if it wasn't requests, then it was okay. The crowd are up for a rock number, they're up for a slow number, you know, they want a smooch, they want to dance, etc. That grew with the experience on stage. So it was very much a case of you know, drawing on their ability to milk an audience, you know, to coin the old expression. And of course, that changed a little bit when we became part of the Epstein stable and, you know, we had to program ourselves to settlers, you know, that freedom of choice went.
You know, and George was the youngest and was always, you know, he had that, the quiet Beatle reputation. Certainly when you listen to the Decca recordings or anything else, I mean, he's singing a bunch of those songs too. Like, what was his role and kind of growth like over those years?
I don't think George was the quietest one. I've been saying now, and I said I was the quiet one. You know, if people see me in real life, they most probably realize that's as far from the truth as you can expect. And I think George fell under that caliber as well. You know, because of the fact that, okay, he was more into, you know, working riffs out on his guitar than, you know, talking. He was, you know, quite happy to sit in the corner and practice, you know, get on with it. But like everything else, when, you know, George had to speak, he spoke. You know, he had a voice, he had an opinion. So again, it was very much at that stage, everyone contributed, you know, everyone had a voice.
You also bonded with John and kind of saw this other side of him. How about with Paul? Were there other sides of Paul that you saw?
Not really. I always saw the, you know, Paul from an early stage. And I think that was from the Casbah as well. He was very PR orientated. Wanted to let everyone know what was going on as regards the band. He was the one who was communicating with people back home in Liverpool when we were in Germany. He was the one who was trying to, you know, let people know what, you know, what was happening in Germany, whereas we were quite happy to go along. It was like, you know, live day by day what was happening in Germany, stayed in Germany, you know. But he was the one very much, and as the world knows now, he was very much, you know, he has become truly most probably the PR guru of the show business world at the moment.
He was the most concerned about your image?
Not so much image. I think a case of basically making people aware of what we were doing, what success we had, and also what we had in line for ourselves. The image thing was something which transpired with Brian, you know. So whether he was in faith or it, George and them were okay with the suits, John and I were anti-suits. But as history portrays now, we did both, you know, we wore suits, right? And this, yeah.
So you got back to Liverpool, you signed with Brian Epstein, and then you had the Decca audition after that, right?
We did. We went there with a lot of hope, I suppose. This is the biggest record company in England. And, you know, there was this New Year's Day, which was the start of the year. And it was, you know, a big thing. And we were, Mike Smith had been down, he'd seen us. And there was an air of, how could I put it? Big headedness, I suppose. You know, we were the Beatles. We were going through the record with the biggest company in England. The fact, if you listen to the Decca record auditions, the fact that we played 14 or 15 numbers in the space of a couple of hours, you know, there's glitches in it, you know, wrong notes, voices crack, etc., etc., etc. But at that stage, Mike Smith, more or less, at the end of that session, turned around and said, yep, more or less got the job. But as history portrays now, it went to Brian Poole and the Tremolos. And because of Brian's endeavours, you know, he kept talking it round the Decca audition tapes till we got that eventual recording contract with EMI.
And the songs that you played at the Decca auditions, did the band choose those or did Brian choose those? Was it representative of like what your shows were?
Brian had basically put it together. And that was one of the reasons we weren't too happy at the Decca audition, because of the song selection. We felt, even though it included some of the original material and some of the songs which he thought would be, had gone down well with the audiences, I think as a band, we felt that we could have chosen better songs. But, you know, we were under the guise of the manager. We thought that he was doing things for us, which he'd, you know, help us. So we went along with playing those particular numbers. When you think about it, there was a cross-section of stuff there which went from rock and roll to original numbers, to country and western, to Carl Perkins. And so it was pretty cross-section of what was happening for us at the time.
You know, in the many years since you were dismissed from the band and you know, obviously startled by it, You know, a lot of time has passed since then. Have you come to process all that differently over time? And sort of how do you look at it now?
Well, I put that to one side many, many years ago. I think I realized after, because of what had happened, it made me take a look at the world outside and basically a look at myself and my, you know, my persona on life. And because of that, I suddenly realized, and it, you know, don't get me wrong, it wasn't, you know, a couple of weeks afterward and everything was okay. It took a period of time, 2 or 3 years, to adjust to the situation because of the success that they were finding. You know, all of a sudden they'd gone from this great rock and roll band to being, you know, leaders of the universe. You know, the Beatles had taken over the world, so to speak. But as regards myself, I think I realized, you know, within a couple of years that it's pointless looking back and reflecting on what could have been and what should have been and what may have been, because that would make you a very bitter and twisted person. You know, and my outlook on life then became, it's not what happened yesterday. It's very much about today and tomorrow. And that's the way I've lived my life ever since, basically.
Yeah.
Very happy with the lifestyle I've got at the present moment. You know, I've got a wonderful family. I'm a great family man. So, yes, I've lost out on certain things, but other stuff I've been well compensated on, which I thank people for.
When's the last time you heard from any of them, talked to any of them, by the way? I mean, obviously, you know, two of them aren't around anymore, but when was the last time you talked to any, you know, George, Paul, John?
Last time I talked to them would be at the cavern the night before I was dismissed.
Never again after that?
No, played on the same bill as them about 2 or 3 times afterwards. We've been support bill to them. We've been that close. I've been on stage when they walked past me. There's been no communications. From that day to this, there's been no communication at all whatsoever.
And not during the anthology project either?
Not during the anthology. That was done through lawyers and done through Apple, but there was no physical contact with any of them.
Well, I have to get out and stay at your... Stay at your bed and breakfast now for sure.
Kev's Suites, August 1, booking on Airbnb.
Okay. I will. I'm gonna get the top floor. I'm gonna go all in style. All
right, take care and thank you.
That's it for episode 141 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Pete Best for taking us back more than 60 years to the birth of the Beatles. I can't tell you what a treat it was to talk with him and to hear those stories firsthand. The Pete Best Band will be in the U.S. for 4 dates from July 25th through 29th in Delaware, Maryland, and Ohio. The tour can't go longer because he's got to get back for the August 1st opening of the Casbah Coffee Club Suites in the Victorian mansion where he grew up. I need to book a room there when I finally make my Liverpool pilgrimage. Go to PeteBest.com for more information, and you could buy his music as well, including the Pete Best Band's 2008 album, Heyman's Green. Caropop is produced by Chris Swaite, who is one cool cat. For a mere $24, you can become a Caropop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at caropop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caropop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at CaroPopcast. And you can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caropop conversation. Thanks.